Well, it's good to be with you again this evening in what I think is an exciting time. I think it's always exciting to see congregations adding to leadership roles and deacon roles. You chose a pastor here not long ago, deacon tonight. It indicates to me that there's some life here, or at least some needs here, and there's an honest attempt being made to meet those needs. So I just, my prayer this evening for you is that God would be present among us and that he would lead and guide and direct in this process, and that you will be able to welcome a new deacon and support him as you have supported the others in the past. I would encourage you to continue to support your leaders here. We lead in difficult times. There are a lot of difficult situations and circumstances in life, some of which congregations never even really become fully aware of, but your leaders will need to deal with them nonetheless. So this is a second message this evening. I understand Jay has already helped you look at the duties of the deacon as outlined in your job description. I think he has spoken a bit about the gifting that it will take for the fulfillment of those responsibilities. Also spoken a bit about the qualifications as given in Acts 6, where seven men were chosen to serve in the role of deacon. That role may vary a bit from congregation to congregation, but I think one thing is clear in Acts 6. There were specific instructions given to choose men to serve in that capacity, to serve the physical and material needs of the congregation. I was just reading a bit today about deacons, the history of deacons, and it's been kind of interesting to see the transition that has taken place over the years from pretty much a model as we would know it in the New Testament, as we would practice ourselves, all the way to deacon boards that actually run the entire church. And now a move again back away from that to deacons as servants, meeting the physical and material needs in the congregation's life. So there were specific instructions given, qualifications were given to aid in their choice. And then those chosen were charged with that responsibility. And that I think you will do in a week or so here when you have an ordination. You will charge that individual with those responsibilities. And in doing that, you will also grant to him the authority to carry out the role or the function to which he is being called and assigned. One thing I want to say yet about an ordination, a licensing, or any other form of charge: when those who are called accept that, it implies a willingness to become accountable to the group who is, or to the entity that is doing the charging. I think sometimes we can forget that. We can begin to think that the office or the role belongs to us who have been called. It does not. It belongs to the church. We serve at God's pleasure and the congregation's pleasure as well. So, in addition to what Jay has shared then this evening, I want us to go to 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 8 through 13. Again, a very familiar passage, but gives us some specific instructions regarding the role of the deacon. And I think the role of deacon is a very critical one. It's very important. We certainly need pastors, there's no question, but we also need deacons. The apostle said it's not right, it's not fit that they should need to leave the work of, or leave the study of the word and prayer to wait on tables. And so deacons were called. And I believe they serve the same role today, that frees up those in pastoral responsibilities to give time to study of the word, to prayer, and to the other ministerial duties to which they're called. The qualifications for pastor and deacon are fairly similar. There are, however, a couple notable differences. One difference is that the deacon is not required to be apt to teach. And I think that possibly suggests that the deacon role is not one in which he will have teaching responsibilities in the congregation. He may teach, don't get me wrong, but that won't be his primary responsibility, not of teaching. Another notable difference, I think, is that while they are to rule their children in their house well, Paul omits the phrase, how will he take care of the church of God? And I think that's an indication, again, that deacons are not given a role as in leading the church, but rather they are in a servant position. Paul says that a deacon is to be tested, but he doesn't say that there cannot be young in the faith or a novice. And perhaps the reason for that is the elder who is chosen, if he's too young, if he's new, a novice, he may be tempted to pride much more readily than someone who is chosen to serve. Both elders and deacons, though, are needed if the church is to function at its best. Let me read then this passage from 1 Timothy, chapter 3, beginning of verse 8, reading from the New King James. Likewise, deacons must be reverent, not double-tongued, not given to much wine, not greedy for money, holding the mystery of the faith with a pure conscience. But let these also first be tested. Then let them serve as deacons, being found blameless. Likewise, their wives must be reverent, not slanderers, temperate, faithful in all things. Let deacons be the husbands of one wife, ruling their children in their own houses well. For those who have served well as deacons obtain for themselves a good standing and great boldness in the faith which is in Christ Jesus. First thing we notice here is in verse 8, and actually there are several here in verse 8, he is to be grave. Or King James uses the word reverent. The contemporary English version uses the word serious. The New English version uses the word dignified. So the term grave here refers to being honorable, respectable, esteemed, worthy. You might call it serious-minded. He's a person with dignity and a serious demeanor. In Ephesians chapter 5, Paul lists a number of sins that are not to be named among us and goes on to include filthiness, nor foolish talking, nor jesting, which are not convenient, but rather the giving of thanks. So the work of deacon is a serious work and requires a serious, sober-minded person to carry out the serious responsibility given to him. The word in the Greek actually includes the idea of honesty. And in 1 Philippians 4:8, when Paul instructs us, finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, and so on, the word used for honest there is the same word used for grave in this passage. So a serious-minded man, and includes the idea of honesty. Second thing then in verse 8 we find is trustworthy, or not double-tongued. And we're speaking here now more of a man's speech as opposed to his bearing or demeanor. I believe there's little else in life that tells us as much as quickly about an individual as his speech. It doesn't take us long to figure out what kind of a person a man is by his speech. I worked as a foreman for a masonry crew for years, and I found speech to be a very accurate way of telling what kind of a man he actually was, to tell what his character and values were. Also found it difficult at times to tell whether he was telling the truth or not. I didn't have the confidence that I was being given the truth. A double-tongued man may say one thing one time and another thing another time. Or he may say one thing and mean something else. And that kind of speech stoops to the level of deception and dishonesty and does little to build respect and trust. In the work of a deacon, sometimes needs become obvious. Just observing people, we may notice there are needs. But at other times, they're not as readily noticeable. But either way, they generally require open and honest communication. I was thinking about this the other day, and I'm thinking, you know, it's interesting that deacons sometimes get cases that have been building up for most of a lifetime, maybe, and then they're expected to fix it just like that, you know, suddenly fix it. It doesn't quite work that way. But generally speaking, it will take time. It will take a lot of communication, open communication, honest communication, to be able to help an individual along with their problems. Let me just say here, in regards to this open and honest communication, as people begin to share with anybody, a pastor, a deacon, even a friend, as they share, they become more vulnerable, and you, the confidant, become more powerful. And the betrayal of that confidence by double-tongued speech is an abuse of the worst sort. We can do more damage with our tongue than we can even begin to imagine. The deacon must be one who can be relied on for the truth of what they say and for the fulfillment of their promises. In other words, they need to say what they mean and mean what they say. And I think we would understand that will include the whole idea of confidence. Again, sometimes things are shared that should not go any further. And when that's the case, then we need to make sure they don't go any further. Our usableness or our usability as a deacon or even as a pastor may be pretty short-lived if we can't maintain confidentiality. If people know that we can't be trusted, we may speak when we should not. Third thing we notice in verse 8 here, not given to much wine. Now, I don't know how you want to argue that one. Some people would say, well, they could drink wine. Well, there may not be an exact prohibition in Scripture that says you can't, but it does say it's not wise. And I think what we're talking about here really is a disciplined life. A deacon must be a man of a disciplined life. Self-discipline must be evident in his life. And I think that includes abstaining from the use of wine. And it would refer to any addictions that we might be prone to. I think it should be noted that this prohibition was generally, universally regarded as necessary for a minister of religion. Even pagan priests going into pagan temples did not drink wine. It was forbidden. The use of wine and strong drink of all kinds was absolutely prohibited to the Jewish ministers of every rank when they were about to engage in the service of the Lord. Leviticus 10:9 talks about that. Moses tells Aaron, when you go into the service of the Lord, you're not to drink any wine or anything intoxicating, lest you die. Ooh, that's strong. Lest you die. And he goes on to explain the reason for that. So that you will be able to distinguish between what is holy and unholy, and between what is clean and unclean. There's something about alcohol, and believe me, I've worked with alcoholics all my life, that clouds the thinking, clouds their reason. It diminishes their judgment. And so Paul is saying here, not to be users of much wine. And we would say not to use any wine. So if that prohibition existed for pagan priests and for Jewish leaders, why should it be any less so for us? Why should we think that we are somehow better than either of those? Addiction to wine or anything else for that matter implies a lack of self-control and is often associated with clouded thinking and poor judgment. And some of the needs that come to deacons as well as other leaders are complex. They're not always simple, they're not always easy, and they will almost always require clear thinking and sound judgment. So it's about self-control, it's about disciplined living. Sometimes the issues that deacons deal with spring from a lack of self-discipline in the life of the individuals or families. How will an individual without any self-discipline or poor self-discipline help a situation where the problem is lack of discipline? So we need self-disciplined brothers to serve in this capacity. Verse 8 again, not greedy for filthy lucre, or one who is unselfish. Now it doesn't say that he can't have money. It doesn't say that he can't have wealth. It says that he should not covet after it. And it's easy to understand how those who are greedy and covet after money might put their own interests ahead of those they are serving. Think of Judas for a minute. Judas was upset because Mary took the ointment, poured it on Jesus' feet, wiped it with her hair. He said, why wasn't this sold for 300 denarii? The money given to the poor. But goes on to say he didn't care anything about the poor. The reason he complained was because he carried a bag and he was a thief. He was interested in his own needs, not the needs of others. Covetousness does that. The Pharisees also were known to oppress widows and others for their own personal gain. So we're not greedy of filthy lucre, not covetous. Isaiah 56:11, speaking of Israel's shepherds, says, yea, they are greedy dogs which can never have enough, and they are shepherds that cannot understand. They all look to their own way, every one for his own gain from his quarter. The work of the deacon is to care and serve for the needs of others, not to seek personal gain. And then moving on to verse 9, he says, holding the mystery of the faith with a pure conscience. I believe the mystery of the faith that he's speaking about here is none other than the gospel of Jesus Christ. Colossians 1:27 says, to whom God would make known what is the riches of the glory of this mystery among the Gentiles, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory. He must hold the mystery of faith. He must fully be convinced of it, must firmly cling to it and apply it to his own life. That, of course, is bound up in the Word, in the gospel, is bound up in the Word of God. He will accept that as infallible, as inerrant, as inspired, as the authority for rule and guide in man's life. I believe it includes a holding to it, it says, in a pure conscience. Not only must he be convinced of it, not only must he accept it for himself, he must live it. Not only preach it, but live it. He must practice what he preaches. And that will aid in his sharing with others. Verse 10, must be blameless. That's the one that makes all of us in leadership shudder. Must be blameless. Really, he must be above reproach. It's not about perfection as we understand it today. None of us would qualify. But it means that a man should be above any charge of immorality or holding false doctrine. If any charge can be brought against such a man implying moral failure and laxity, he is not fit for the office. So he needs to be a man of irreproachable character for truth, honesty, chastity, and general uprightness. And this blamelessness, Paul says here, is discovered through testing. Didn't say he can't be young, didn't say he can't be a novice, but it does say he should be tested. And the way we test is through observation in the congregation, and I think you have a policy here that person needs to be here 2 years, and that will give you time to observe their character and their integrity and their conduct in public as well as in the life of the congregation as well. He moves now to the wife. And maybe the women wonder why this is it here. I'm not sure. But he said he must have a godly wife down here in verse 11. Let me just find that quickly again. Likewise, their wives must be reverent. I don't take this to mean that he must be married. But if he is married, then his wife needs to be a godly wife, needs to be a reverent wife. Paul says the deacon's wives must be dignified, not slanderers, but sober-minded, faithful in all things. And the wife's character is important because of the sensitive and sometimes confidential nature of the deacon's responsibility. I know men who say they share everything with their wives. Anything they hear, they share with their wives. I've chosen not to do that, not because I don't trust my wife. I just don't want to put her in a position of having to remember, can I share or can't I share? But because of that sensitive nature, a deacon's wife needs to be able to be trusted. And I would just say this, if people with needs have trouble trusting the deacon's wife, they're probably not going to share with the deacon. And so it is important as to the kind of wives that our deacons have. It inspires trust and confidence in the lives of some people. There are also maybe times in which a deacon's wife can relate to another wife in ways that the deacon can't and can be a very valuable asset in that regard. Verse 12, then, he is to be the husband of one wife. And I can remember when people talked about not divorce and remarriage, and I don't hear that a lot anymore, although that would be our position. But most commentators today would interpret that as being a one-woman man. And Genesis 2 makes that same point, doesn't it? One-woman man. But I believe Paul here is addressing a man's faithfulness to his wife. We have men who are very careful not to become involved physically with other women. There are men in the church, however, I'm afraid, who have become emotionally involved with other women. Emotional infidelity is destructive, just as physical infidelity is. And I think what we're calling for here is a man who is both physically and emotionally faithful to his wife. He is not intimate in any way, emotionally or physically, with another woman. And finally, then he says, manage your children and household well. He is to be the leader in his home, spiritual leader of his wife and children. His primary role is not that of leading in the church, but he does need to lead in his home. And if he's not a spiritual leader at home, then he will have difficulty in some of the other relationships, working with families, where there needs to be some improvement in spiritual leadership in the home as well. Well, again, many of these here speak as much to character as they do to specific types of abilities. But it is what we're called to. And let me just review again what I've gone down over here for you. First of all, serious-minded, trustworthy, self-disciplined, unselfish, and a committed and mature Christian, above reproach, married, if he's married, to a godly wife, a committed, faithful husband and leader in his home. Now, that's the short version. We could have gone on a bit longer, but my prayer, my hope for you this evening is that as Jay has shared, and perhaps if I've shared this evening, God's Spirit has moved you and has been leading you as to a name to share with us, the name of someone who you believe God could use in a mighty way to serve in this role, in this capacity here in this congregation. So God bless you as you continue with the process.